so there's no sunlight or nightfall. I'm being fed by a tube, so it's not like my meals vary from scrambled eggs to chicken with rice. And it's still hard for me to summon the strength and focus to speak. So I try to reserve that effort for questions more burning than whether it's 3 in the afternoon or 2 in the morning. I measure the passage of time instead by my sister's changes of clothes. Since I first opened my eyes, Patty has worn 3 different outfits. So either I've been out of the coma for 3 days, or she likes to change up her wardrobe a whole lot. Pop is here less often. Being chief of D's is a big job, and he can only delegate the daily duties for so long. My brothers have stuck around the hospital, but spend a lot of time out in the hallway, calling home or opening laptops and sending things back and forth to Dallas and St. Louis. The 2 constants have been Goldie and Patty, who have been by my bedside pretty much every time my eyes are open. Everyone has kept it light so far. I've asked questions, but received no answers. Just a lot of evasive responses like, "Just focus on getting better," and "We can talk about that later." I've asked what happened to put me here. I've asked who shot me. I've asked who it was I shot. But the question I ask most often is, "Where is Kate?" I can think in full sentences. At least, I think I can. It doesn't translate when I open my mouth. The connection between my injured brain and my mouth is like the signal I receive on my phone when I'm driving through the South Side. Sometimes it works, sometimes it's fuzzy, sometimes it completely disconnects. I'm not paralyzed either. Everything works. Not well, not yet, but I'm okay. I remember arresting the mayor now. That memory came back when my sister was wearing a green shamrock t-shirt. Today she's wearing something brown, so I think it was yesterday. Yesterday the bust came back to me, along with the shitstorm that followed. I remember the superintendent was pissed off, and the state's attorney appointed a woman, a real knockout, to investigate me and Kate, to look into whether I stole the little black book at the brownstone. Every day, every change of Patty's clothes, I remember a few more things. I remember the name of the investigator, Amy Lentini. I remember being suspended. Kate, too. I remember talking to Goldie at a coffee shop, thinking that this whole thing was a lot bigger than a stupid black book, that it was an excuse to get to me. I remember thinking that someone had figured out that I worked undercover for internal affairs and that whoever it was used the mayor's bust as an excuse to silence me. Cut! That's it! That's where it ends in a cloud of smoke. Like my memory is a car speeding away, leaving me in the dust. My doctor, an Indian guy named Pamaresh, said most things will come back to me sooner or later, but probably not the traumatic events themselves. "You'll probably never remember the shooting or the events that immediately preceded it," he said. "It's called retrograde amnesia." Patty is working her phone, humming to herself, unaware that my eyes have opened again. She looks so tired, so pale, so wrung out. It was hard for Patty growing up. She was mostly coddled, 3 brothers hovering over her, protecting her. But she never shook the insecurity that gripped her, especially when she was compared to me, her twin brother. I never knew what was so special about me. But in her mind, I exceeded her in every way. Smarter, more athletic, more popular, better looking. I never understood it. Something grabbed hold of her at a young age and never let go. Something that told her she wasn't good enough. But it never came between us. Whatever she felt about me, she never held it against me. We've been together during highs and lows. When everything happened 3 years ago, Patty took it as hard as I did. It was almost as if it had happened to her. "Kate?" I say, not even trying to put together a string of words. Patty looks up from her phone. "Morning, sunshine." She leans over and carefully kisses my forehead. My head is shaved and heavily bandaged. The top of my skull is still sitting in a mason jar somewhere, and I'm still connected to tubes and electrodes and machines. They're feeding me, monitoring my brain and heart functions, even massaging my limbs with electric pulses so I don't lose circulation. "Kate," I say again, my eyes level with hers. "Please." Patty's eyes drift about, considering the question. We are alone in the room. Not even Goldie's here. She tries to touch my face, my head, but there's nowhere to place her hand. Her eyes well up with tears. She has probably cried enough to fill Niagara Falls. I'm sorry to do this to her, but I need to know, and I know she'll tell me if nobody's around to stop her. Kate's dead, Billy. The shooting. You survived. She didn't. Something expels from my mouth. A low moan. I thought this was coming. It was hard to think of another reason why Kate wouldn't have been here to visit me. But hearing it, confirming it, something snaps inside me like a twig. "We aren't sure what happened," she tells me. I let her down. I was supposed to cover her back. That's what a partner does. I didn't do that. Oh, Kate. Oh, Kate. Who? Who? Patty watches me, dreading the question. Injured brain or not, I can read her like a book. She knows what I'm trying to ask. Who killed Kate? "We don't know what happened," she repeats, this time less convincingly. A robotic repetition, like a shield against further inquiry. "We don't know." The more she says it, the clearer it is to me that she's lying. And why would she lie about that? Why wouldn't she want me to know who shot Kate? No. No. It can't be. Poison through my veins, a weight crushing my chest, stealing my breath. Some of the machines start making noises, bells and whistles. Patty pushes a button and calls for the nurse. The door pops open, and doctors and nurses rush in. Before Patty steps aside, she leans into me. "Whatever anyone tries to tell you about what happened," she whispers, "don't believe it." 25. "This is a bad idea," says Patty. "It's a terrible idea." It's the best idea I've had in the 14 weeks I've been here. I fit my arm through the sleeve of my button-down shirt. I don't care, I'm not spending another night in this place. Nothing against the hospital, which has treated me more than well. The room to which I was transferred had a window overlooking the lake, which was nice, though it reminded me of the view from Kate's condo in Lakeview. The people doing my rehab were good souls too, exhibiting more patience with me than they would with a child, coaxing me into one more step, or one more bicep curl with a 10-pound weight, or one more recitation of Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers, or one more round of counting backwards from 20. It was brutal at first, but they got me back on my feet. I can dress myself and feed myself and walk, albeit with a cane. I can speak in full sentences and read and write. My vision is almost as good as it used to be. My sense of humor, for better or worse, is still intact. And my skull is fully reattached, thank you very much. My hair is growing back a little straighter than it was before, and right now is the length of a buzz cut. I've lost about 20 pounds. I have a scar where the bullet entered my brain. But the rest of the repairs the doctors did to my noggin are covered by hair. Yes, if you look closely enough, you can see scars that read like a road map all across the top and back of my skull. But I can live with it. The fact that I can live at all, I realize, is a small miracle. So I'm leaving. 98 days after taking a bullet to the brain. "You need another month of rehab at least," Patty says. "So I'll do it as an outpatient, or I'll do it at home. It's not like I'm going back on the job right away. I need medical clearance before they'll let me back to work, even at a desk. A lot of coppers I know would take the disability leave without complaint, as though it were a paid vacation. But not me. I can't bear the thought of watching game shows and daytime talk shows and soap operas. I'll think of something. Mostly I'll work on getting myself back in shape to get back to my job. But none of that is why I want to go home. Yes, I'm stir crazy in here. Yes, I want to be a cop again. But the real reason is that I want control again. My family, Patty in particular, has controlled my access to information and the news. All I know about the shooting after 14 weeks is that 3 people were found shot, and 2 of them, Amy Lentini and Kate, were already dead. I was clinging to life. And I know that the shooting happened in Amy Lentini's apartment. And though neither Patty nor anyone else has ever actually confirmed it, it sounds like everyone thinks I shot Kate. I haven't pushed the issue. Once I came up against resistance, once everyone started deflecting the issue, I decided to lay low. That's where I'm at my most effective. When I've receded into the background. When I'm the funny, harmless guy. The comedian. The baby brother. The fourth stooge. I'm at my best when everyone underestimates me. So that's what I'll do. I'll be the guy recovering from the brain injury. The guy with the limp. The guy who moves and acts and thinks slowly. The guy who probably, likely, will never be the same again. The guy who's no longer a threat. Let them all think that. I don't know how I got to Amy's place the night of the shooting. I don't remember any of the circumstances leading up to it. I've lost days and weeks before that point in time. And I can't for the life of me figure out why on God's green earth I would shoot my partner. But I'm going to find out. 26. Detective? The woman who enters the room is tall and thin, with ash-colored hair pulled back, wearing black-rimmed glasses and a sleeveless red dress and heels. I try not to stare, because I'm a gentleman. I'm Dr. Jagoda, she says. I rise from my seat and shake her hand. Billy Harney. She sits across from me. Lush, high-backed leather chairs, like something in a reading room somewhere. All we're missing is a fireplace and a snifter of brandy. She doesn't just look nice. She also smells nice. Her perfume fresh and clean, not overpowering. On the dark walls, diplomas from Harvard and Yale, certificates from various psychology associations. So how does this work? I ask. I tell you my mommy didn't show me enough affection, and then I realize, I shake my fists and bite my lip, as if in a moment of self-discovery. I realize that I'm not a bad person. And then we both have a good cry and I go find happiness. She observes all this with a poker face. No tell whatsoever. How do you want it to work? The truth? Preferably. I don't want to be here at all. I never would have guessed. But I have no choice. The department says I got to see a shrink. You know, on account of my traumatic experience and all. Her eyes narrow. That psychologist appraisal thing. You did this before, she says. 3 years ago. 3 years ago, I didn't want to do it either. But did it help? Not really. So, she claps her hands and leans forward. There's a table separating us. A small, round wooden job with a design on it that looks Middle Eastern. What do you hope to get out of it this time? I hope to get out of here, period. I say. No offense, but I don't need a shrink. Why don't you think you need a shrink? I look at her. Do you just ask questions? Do you ever make affirmative statements? Do you want me to? She allows a small curve of a smile, her face otherwise deadpan. At least that time she was joking. What kind of name is Jagoda? She sits back in her chair, crosses her legs. Polish, she says. You know how many poles it takes to screw in a light bulb? I ask. 3. One to hold the bulb, and 2 to rotate the chair he's standing on. You know how many cops it takes? She replies. 3. One to screw it in, and 2 to violate the civil rights of a black guy standing nearby. Well played. You want to know the thinnest book ever written? The Complete List of Polish War Heroes. Oh, but the Irish have made a real contribution to the world. I could mention beer and potatoes, but I don't. How about you just give me a diagnosis and send me on my way, I say. Let's go with post-traumatic stress disorder. Write me up a prescription, and I'll promise to take my meds. She cocks her head. I'm good at what I do, detective, but somehow I don't think I'm prepared to make a full diagnosis after meeting you for 5 minutes and simply reading your file. I'll settle for a partial diagnosis then. Oh, a partial one. That's easy, she says. You're batshit crazy. I actually let out a laugh. The first one I can remember. Okay, she's good for a chuckle or two. But this is still a waste of time. I get out of my chair. See you around, Doc, I say. You're extremely intelligent, she says, as I'm headed for the door. Far more so than you're willing to let on. You're emotionally wounded, probably from what happened 3 years ago, as well as what just happened. but you bury it all underneath this facade of being the smartass, the comedian. Humor is your shield. You're hiding. You've probably been hiding for so long that you don't even realize it anymore. I don't respond. I don't move. She turns and looks at me, eyebrows raised. I break eye contact. You're broken, she says. You know it and I know it, but I can help put you back together. Who knows, I might even help you get your memory back. I look at the door, even reach for it with my hand. Go ahead and walk if you want. I won't stop you. Make a decision, Billy. I draw my hand back from the door. I slowly swivel around and look at the shrink. Then I return to the chair and sit down. You can get my memory back? No guarantee, she says. But I'm your only shot. The past. 27. More bad news for us, said Kate as she drove the Tahoe with me in the passenger seat. I pulled up the website on my phone and immediately spotted it. Another story from the online rag Chicago PC, once again courtesy of Kim Beans, the formerly disgraced TV reporter making a spirited comeback with the photographs she obtained from the Brownstone brothel. The heading of the article read, Peek-a-boo, Francis! The photo captured Mayor Francis Delaney walking up the steps of the now infamous Brownstone. Only he wasn't bundled up. He was in a light jacket and wearing a baseball cap. It was taken in warm weather. In other words, not during the night 2 weeks ago when we made the bust. The point being that the night I caught the mayor of Chicago with his pants at his ankles was not the first time he'd visited the Brownstone. You're right. This is absolutely outrageous, I said. How could the mayor wear a Cubs cap? Kate shot me a look. Not funny. See, Kate considered this photo of the mayor bad news because she considered anything in the news about this story to be bad. And she was right. In the 2 weeks that had passed since we arrested the mayor and everyone else at the Brownstone, the national media had caught wind of this story. And once it did, it held on like a pit bull on a mailman's leg. When the 24/7 news outlets, CNN, Fox, MSNBC, Bloomberg, whatever, sink their teeth into a story, they demand further juicy details and gobble up every little nugget, big or small, verified or unverified. It turns up the heat on everyone under the microscope. Consider, for example, our state's attorney, Margaret Olson. Last week, a reporter from CNN looked at her campaign contribution reports and realized that she owed her election as the top prosecutor to Mayor Delaney, who provided her with significant financial support. Under a news segment entitled, Conflict of Interest, the anchor questioned whether Maximum Margaret would go easy on the mayor because of all he'd done for her. That prompted the state's attorney to hold a news conference in which she announced that she would be accepting no plea bargains for any defendant accused of soliciting prostitutes that night in the Brownstone, whether that person was someone of prominence, read Mayor Delaney or Archbishop Phelan or the Green Bay Packers QB, or an ordinary Joe. And she would be seeking maximum sentences for all of them. The sex club case was headed to trial soon, and everyone involved was hunkering down, bracing for the next splashy revelation to emerge, hoping that it wouldn't be their ox that got gored. And every news outlet, every reporter covering this case, was looking for the little black book that mysteriously disappeared from the Brownstone that night. So things were tense, but Kate needed to look on the bright side, too. There'd been some good news. The disciplinary board that oversees police officer cases ordered that Kate and I be reinstated to duty while we waited for the hearing on our alleged misconduct. The police superintendent, Tristan Driscoll, had suspended us immediately, on the spot. But the board said we got to remain on duty until he proved his case against us. So after taking an unplanned 2-week vacation, I was a cop again. At least for now. And so was Kate. I can't believe we have to go and play nice with that bitch, she mumbled. Amy Lentini, she meant, the special investigator assigned to the sex club case, who'd been trying to prove for the last 2 weeks that either Kate or I, or both of us, stole the little black book naming customers at the Brownstone brothel. Since Kate and I were the arresting officers, we would be required to testify at the trial and prepare for it with Lentini in advance. Personally, I'd rather have my wisdom teeth pulled without Novocaine. But nobody asked me my opinion. It won't be so bad, I said. Oh, I'm sure you won't mind. Another look shot in my direction. The Italian beauty fluttering those eyes at you. That's not fair at all, and you know it, I said. It's her ass I like the most. This isn't a joke, Billy. There it was again. That jealousy thing. Kate and I had been partners for years, and I never seriously considered anything between us. Then it flared up after the brownstone arrests, and I admit it was pretty great. Crazy and kinkier than I was used to, but great. But then we were suspended, and though we talked every day for those 2 weeks, nothing else happened. It was like the suspension of our official relationship pushed the pause button on the sex part, too. Now that we were back together as cops, I wondered if we would hit the play button again, and I couldn't decide if it was a good idea or not. Amy Lentini is a wolf in sheep's clothing, said Kate. She'll draw you in, nice and close, and stick in the knife. Kate pulled the car over next to Daly Plaza. Parking wasn't ordinarily allowed there, but the cops looked the other way for one another. That was one of the perks of the job. The pay sucks. The pension is shaky. People curse at you and try to goad you into anger while recording you on their smartphones, and you never know when someone might stick a gun in your face, but hey, the parking is great. Watch yourself around her, is all I'm saying, Kate warned me as she threw the car into park. You could get us both in trouble. 28. Detective Harney, Detective Fenton, good morning. Assistant State's Attorney Amy Lentini was all business when we walked into her office. She was decked out in a crisp blue suit that hugged her nicely, a perfect blend of professionalism and flattery. She cleaned up good, I had to admit. She showed us to seats and stood by the window, overlooking Daly Plaza. The fact that she had an office with a window said something about her status here. I still didn't know her story, how she moved up the chain, whom she knew. Hell, for all I knew, she got where she was on her merits. It was a first time for everything. Congratulations on your reinstatement, she said, with no trace of irony. It's only temporary until the board rules on the merits of our case, I said. Something about the presumption of innocence. I think we have that in this country. That sounds familiar, she replied, deadpan. Some people still want us kicked off the force. Oh, wait, I snapped my fingers. That someone is you. Her head inclined to the right, the beginning of a smirk on her face. It's a delicate situation. A delicate situation, Kate said, mimicking her. You really are a lawyer. I'm a lawyer who's not going to lose this case, said Amy. And you, detectives, are my case, whether I like it or not. So putting this business about the little black book aside, we need to be ready for the attack. She opened her hands. Although, believe me, any time you want to tell me what happened to that black book, I'm all ears. Sure she was. She must have assumed that other celebrities and politicians and power brokers were featured in that tell-all book. She was an ambitious prosecutor who'd stumbled on a career maker of a case. The bigger the fish, the bigger the boost to her career. We don't know what happened to that book, said Kate. Amy narrowed her eyes at Kate but didn't answer. Nothing was going to be resolved between her and us, probably ever, on that score. You're going to be attacked, she said. The defense doesn't have much else to say. The mayor, the archbishop, all the men you caught, they have no defense to this crime. You caught them, in some cases, literally, with their pants down. Yeah, it wasn't the archbishop's finest moment. I didn't remember the mayor coming off so well either. So their only avenue is to attack the police, Amy went on, pacing by the window. They will challenge the constitutionality of your entry into the brownstone. They'll say you lacked probable cause. Piece of cake, I said. I had information that that brownstone was a brothel. They weren't going in there to play bingo. Oh, okay. So this case will be easy, Amy said, dripping with sarcasm. I sat back in my chair. Easy as Sunday morning. So you won't mind if I ask you a few questions about it? Shoot. Okay. Amy looked up at the ceiling, as though she were recalling events. So you went to that brownstone to confront a man whom you suspected of murdering that student at the University of Chicago. That's how it started. That's why we were there in the first place. But then it all changed. Suddenly you were a vice cop. Suddenly you didn't care one iota about that suspect. Suddenly you wanted to bust up a prostitution ring. Yeah, the focus changed. I was witnessing a crime in progress.
What crime did you witness in progress?
Did you see some prostitute screwing some guy? Did you see money changing hands? Obviously not, I said.
Obviously not. You were outside in your car.
So you saw a bunch of individual men walking into a brownstone. A brownstone I knew to be a brothel.
Run that by me again. How'd you know it was a brothel?
She scratched her cheek in mock curiosity. I had been following my suspect. I saw him going in there the week before. I had a suspicion about what he was doing, but I wasn't sure.
You weren't sure because all you saw the week before, when you were trailing the suspect, was a man walking into the brownstone and then coming back out later.
Right. It's not a crime to walk in and out of a brownstone, is it?
Obviously not.
You didn't hear him say, "Gee, I just had sex with a prostitute." I gave her a cold smile. He wasn't wearing a sign around his neck that said, "Just got a blowjob," was he? She asked.
It was more like one of those sandwich boards, I said. One side said, "I just paid someone for sex." The other side said, "I also killed a UFC undergrad, arrest me."
She stared at me.
"You're correct, counselor," I said. When I was following the suspect, all I saw was him going in and coming out.
So you had no idea what was going on inside that brownstone.
But then I sat on the place, I said.
You did recon?
Sure, recon. I sat on the place. I saw young, beautiful women going into the place and older men going in too.
Did you know for a fact that any of those young women were prostitutes?
For a fact, no. But the way they were dressed made me think so.
Well, Amy said, opening her hands. How were they dressed?
Like hookers, I said, showing a lot of leg, hair teased up, lots of makeup.
So all women who dress provocatively are hookers?
Of course not.
Most of them are?
No, I said, leaning forward. But I watched maybe a dozen young women walk into that place and then a bunch of much older men.
How do you know they didn't go to separate floors of that brownstone? Amy asked. How do you know that the women weren't having a party in the garden apartment and the men weren't a bunch of old college buddies watching the Bulls game together in a different apartment?
I shook my head. I was playing a hunch that night. The law of probabilities, going with instinct. That's what cops do.
No, I wasn't positive that brownstone was a brothel, but it sure as hell looked like it.
Still, I had to admit, she had just tied me in knots. I was beginning to think I'd underestimated Amy Lentini.
Amy moved away from the window, came around the desk, and stood against it, facing me head on.
And I was being gentle, she said. The mayor and the archbishop have hired two of the best defense lawyers in the country. If you didn't have probable cause to enter that brownstone, our whole case is gone. And they won't blame me for that.
No. Everyone would blame me. The cop who muffed the search.
So believe it or not, she said, like it or not, I'm on your side.
29. 2 hours later, Kate and I were in the elevator, heading out of Daily Center. Another person got in with us, but checked out two floors below, leaving us alone. The moment the doors closed and it was just us, Kate punched me in the arm.
Ow! What's your problem?
You're my problem, she said. I rubbed my arm. The kid could pack a punch.
When the elevator door popped back open, we walked through the lobby, full of lawyers and cops and sheriff's deputies, even a small group protesting police brutality, which was probably allowed to come inside because it was so freaking cold out in the plaza. I zipped my coat up to my neck and pushed through the revolving door.
So how am I your problem? I asked. Because I played nice with the prosecutor?
Because you're an idiot. Kate answered, walking so fast I could hardly keep up with her.
Hey,
I said, stopping, hoping she'd stop too. She did, turning around, something in her eyes suggesting concern, maybe hurt. "My ass is on the line," I said. "If the search gets tossed and I blew the arrest on the mayor of Chicago, then I really look like an idiot."
"I see. So the prosecutor is helping you."
I nod. I thought she had a point, yeah. She's smart. She's thorough.
"Oh, she's smart. I'll give her that."
I opened my arms.
"So?"
Kate smiled, but not a smile of happiness. More like a grinning Barrett smile.
"She is playing you like a fiddle, detective."
"Oh, now it's detective? Not Billy?"
Kate walked over to me. "In case you hadn't noticed, my ass is on the line too. And my fate is basically in your hands, which means I have to sit and watch while she leads you around wherever she wants you to go. You have a serious blind spot."
"I don't see that," I said.
She leaned in nice and close, her mouth next to my ear. "That's why they call it a blind spot."
She stepped back and shoved me, this time in the shoulder.
"So yeah, now it's detective," she said. "We're partners on the job, and that's all we are. We always said it was a one-nighter, right? Even if it was more than one night."
She tossed me the keys to our car, still parked in the fire lane on Clark.
"Come on, Kate," I said. "You're not even going to ride with me?"
She started away, but turned again, facing me, giving me a good long once-over.
"Did you take the black book?" she asked.
"What?"
It felt like a punch to the gut.
"I can't believe you'd even ask me that."
She was only about 5 yards away from me, but suddenly it felt like the distance between us was measured in miles. The woman who rode with me for almost 5 years, who went through doors with me, who solved murders and rapes with me, who cried in my arms when her father died 2 years ago, who spent hours in the hospital with me 3 years ago, when everything happened, that woman was gone. Now all I had was a partner who didn't trust me.
"Did you take it?"
I asked back. I felt something break between us. She did too. Her reaction wasn't anger, but sadness, loss. She broke eye contact with me and walked away. And she never answered the question. But then again, neither did I.
30.
"There he is," Lieutenant Mike Goldberger said. "The newly reinstated detective."
We met at a pub by the station, though it was for lunch only, not beers.
"Congratulations," he said.
I bumped fists with him. Goldie was saying all this as though he'd just heard the news. I seriously doubted that. I had a sneaking suspicion that Goldie had something to do with my reinstatement. Did he know somebody on the police disciplinary board? I wasn't sure, but it wouldn't surprise me. Goldie had a gift for networking. His current position, heading internal affairs, was really a perfect fit for him. He was the consummate behind-the-scenes player. He never sought credit, but you always knew that when things happened, somewhere behind a curtain, Goldie was turning the levers. And if he did know someone on the disciplinary board, if he did pull a string or call in a favor to get me reinstated, he'd never tell me. It wasn't his way. I never thought I'd work for BIA. Most cops don't. Most cops, you put a gun to their head, they wouldn't work in the bureau that investigates other cops. I was resistant myself. I only agreed to do it because it was Goldie who was asking, and because he promised that it wouldn't involve rinky-dink stuff. My job wasn't to catch cops doing little things like fudging a timesheet, or tardiness, or missing a court appearance, or uttering a politically incorrect word or two at the station. No, we would stick to the important stuff. Major crimes, big-time corruption. As far as I knew, nobody but Goldie and I knew that I was undercover. Not even my sister, Patty, or my father knew. Nor did Kate. It felt odd not telling those people closest to me. But really, I was doing them a favor. I was working on something that could be pretty explosive. And if my role came out, a lot of shit would hit a lot of fans. My family and Kate would be better off claiming, truthfully, that they never knew a thing about it. We sat at the bar and ordered corned beef sandwiches. The bartender put a wicker basket of popcorn in front of us. We dove into it, stuffing handfuls into our mouths. "I had 2 weeks sitting on my suspended ass doing nothing but thinking about this," I said. and all I could think was, this whole thing with the little black book isn't about a little black book at all. It's about me. Somebody made me. Somebody knows I'm undercover. Somebody knows what I'm investigating. And whoever it is wants to stop me.
Nobody knows what you're investigating. Nobody but me. Your name isn't anywhere.
Goldie looked over at me.
You told me you never told anyone. Not your sister, not your partner.
I didn't.
Then nobody knows but you and me. You're a ghost, as far as that's concerned.
He whacked my arm with the back of his hand.
How'd your meeting go with the prosecutor?
I drew back. What, you know everything I do now?
Kid, I know what you had for breakfast today.
That was Goldie. Eyes and ears everywhere. I couldn't have a better person looking out for me. This trial's gonna be a bitch, I said. She's afraid they're gonna punt the whole thing on probable cause.
Translation? It would be your fault,
Goldie said, cutting right to the chase. No fucking fooling.
Ride it out, he said. You never know when the winds might shift.
I looked at him. Goldie never opened his mouth without a reason. Talk to me, I said. He shrugged.
I'm just saying. The state's attorney's golden girl, Lentini. The one who 2 weeks ago was trying to make you for stealing the ledger.
The little black book.
Right. Now she's the one trying the brownstone case. Now she needs you. That strike you as odd?
It did, actually. What do you think it means?
Maybe our good state's attorney is recalculating. Maybe Maximum Margaret is taking a lay of the land and seeing things different.
How so?
Well, her first reaction was, you took down the mayor, and the mayor's her Chinaman, right? He's the reason she became state's attorney, so she was trying to smear you.
For sure.
But now?
Goldie threw up his hands.
Maybe she's thinking, hell, the mayor doesn't have a prayer now. He's going down for this thing, so she might as well make the best of it.
Goldie looked at me.
Somebody's got to take the mayor's place, right?
I hadn't thought of that. Maximum Margaret Olson could be the next mayor.
Sure.
Of course.
This Amy Lentini, Goldie went on. She's their ace. She was a federal prosecutor up in Wisconsin. You remember a couple years back that U.S. senator up there went down for taking a bribe?
She did that case?
Yep. She's the real deal.
Wisconsin? Huh.
Yep. Born in Appleton. Went to Madison for undergrad. Harvard Law.
Our sandwiches arrived. Corned beef piled high on rye. A huge spear of a pickle and thick potato chips. Why am I not surprised that you know all about her? I said.
It's my job.
Goldie took a massive bite of his sandwich. I did the same.
The situation's fluid, is all I'm saying, he went on. Nobody knows which side to be on, so just ride it out for now.
That sounded about right.
Stay close to Amy Lentini, he said. Keep an eye on her.
That wouldn't be hard. I didn't really have a choice anyway.
But more important than any of that, solve your problem,
Goldie said, running his tongue over his teeth.
Find that little black book. That's the key to everything for you. You find that thing, your problems are solved.
Damn straight. Now that I was back on the force, that would be my priority.
How's our thing going, by the way?
He asked. My undercover investigation, he meant. The one that only Goldie and I knew about. The one that, if it came out the way I thought it might, would turn the Chicago Police Department upside down. I'm close, I said.
How close?
Soon, I said. Very soon. 31.
Welcome back, sport.
Sosha smacked me on the back as he passed by my desk.
You miss me? I got no one to talk to. My new partner, he doesn't like hockey. How do you not like hockey?
He meant Reynolds, his partner, the rookie in the detectives bureau. The cops with me on the raid that night were detectives Lanny Sosha, Rick Reynolds, Matt Crowley, and Brian Benson. But it was hard to imagine Sosha, whom I'd known since we were cadets in the academy, doing anything like that.
Reynolds was so green I wasn't sure he was even toilet trained yet. Nice kid, but he didn't know detective work from needlepoint. Crowley? The guy was pushing retirement. I was pretty sure he was in adult diapers by this point. And Benson? I mean, a great guy, good for a laugh, and he'd have your back when it got sticky out there. But he didn't have an original thought in his brain. And really, none of those four detectives had volunteered for the assignment. I asked them to come along only because I had a hunch that busting into a Gold Coast brownstone might get a little messy. I didn't realize how messy. But the point is that none of these guys had any idea I'd asked them to come along until earlier that day. Whoever took that little black book didn't do it on the spur of the moment. He was thinking things through. He had a plan. He, or she, that is. As if on cue, Kate walked in, throwing her bag down on her desk without a word to me, or even a glance in my direction. I felt the temperature plummet.
Harney!
Lieutenant Wisniewski, the Wiz, my supervisor, wiggled his fingers at me. The Wiz was there that night, too. He tried to talk me out of the bust. It felt like an old-school Agatha Christie novel. One of the people in this room is the thief. One of you took that little black book. The corned beef sandwich sat like a brick in my stomach. I needed some coffee. The coffee maker, a glass container that was probably purchased during the Eisenhower administration, held only a trace of burned sludge at this point in the day, and I didn't feel like going to the effort of making more, so I passed it without stopping. Yeah, Lou, I said, leaning against the doorway of Lieutenant Wisniewski's office. Wisniewski's desk looked like a hoarder's paradise, with piles of paper threatening to topple over. The place reeked of cigar smoke, and he had a half-smoked stogie resting on the corner of the table. No smoking, boss, I said. Maybe you hadn't heard.
You see me smoking it?
Wisniewski was a politician first, a cop second. If what Goldie said was right, and nobody was sure which way all this was going to play out, the Wiz must have been reading tarot cards at night. If that was all I could say about the Wiz, I could live with him. There are politicians in every police force, ass-kissers, suck-ups. But word was that the Wiz was a dirty cop, and he was on my radar in the undercover investigation I was doing. He just didn't know it yet. I was very much looking forward to the day he did.
I just wanted to give you some friendly advice, he said to me.
Yeah, what's that?
Don't fuck up again.
That's good advice, Lou. Hang on. I patted my pockets. You got a pen and paper? I want to write that down before I forget it. The top of his head turned red. It always did when you got a rise out of him, which wasn't hard.
Oh, he's a comedian, this one.
He seemed like he was looking for something amid the clutter on his desk. He couldn't find something on that desk if it was set on fire. I'm going to find that black book, I said, staring at him. He stopped what he was doing and looked up at me.
Yeah? Why are you telling me that?
I just thought you'd want to know. Seemed like he took it for the accusation it was. I didn't think that forehead could get any redder.
Best of luck with that, he said evenly.
32. Ramona de la Vue walked out of her house just past 7. She looked like the wealthy woman she was, wearing an expensive long fur coat and matching hat, her bleached blonde hair hanging down in a stylish bob, her head held high, a confident strut to her walk. She didn't go far. There was a car waiting for her outside, an average-looking Chevy sedan. Uber, probably, or maybe someone she knew. I was in my car, so I followed behind. Parking in Lincoln Park is tricky, so this could pose a problem for me. If she was in an Uber car, as I suspected, she could just be dropped off, and I'd have to park my unmarked vehicle somewhere. Ramona de la Vue was released on bond after her arrest 2 weeks ago at the Brownstone. As the manager of the Brownstone brothel, she was the best lead to the little black book. That night she denied its existence in a profanity-laden tirade that took some of the polish off her sophisticated veneer. But the point was that she didn't tell a squat. She lawyered up almost immediately and refused to answer our questions at the police station, too. The $5,000 she had to come up with to get sprung was probably chump change to her. I didn't have much to go on.
She had a record consisting of two priors, one for prostitution and one for promoting it. She had graduated into the big time with the Brownstone Brothel and its exclusive clientele, but I didn't know much else about her. All I knew for sure was that we had put her brothel out of business, and she'd be looking for another way to make some money. The car dropped her off in the Gold Coast, south of Lincoln Park on Rush Street. Tyson's was a high-end restaurant with a bar, where on occasion one might find an aging, unattractive man with an uncommonly beautiful woman on his arm. I double-parked my car and took my time crossing the street. I had no idea what I was going to find. More than likely, she was just meeting someone for dinner and drinks, in which case I'd strike out, just as I'd struck out the other times I'd followed her over the last 2 weeks. So far, no luck, but a Boy Scout keeps trying. The place was packed. The circle of people around the bar, three deep at least, all sorts of merriment and chatting. The lighting was dim, and there was some kind of jazz swing music coming over the speakers. Loud and crowded was a good thing. It made it easier for me to disappear. I pulled out my phone for a couple of reasons. One, if I needed to duck my head quickly to avoid detection, I'd have an excuse for staring downward. And two, I might need the camera on the device. I looked around the place and didn't see her on a first pass. She could be in the dining area, which would be harder for me. She was wearing a fur coat, but she might have taken it off by now. That reminded me of a joke, and I hadn't sent my friend Stuart anything for a week or so. So I put my iPhone camera on the video setting and spoke into it. "A guy named Jerry gets out of the shower at his country club," I said. "The cell phone by his locker is ringing, and he answers it. 'Honey,' the woman on the other end says, 'I just saw a fur coat I've been dying to buy. It's $5,000. Jerry says, "Wow, $5,000 for a coat? That's a lot. But go ahead, it's okay." She says, "Well, since you're in a good mood, I just passed a Mercedes dealership, and there's a new model I just love, but it's $150,000. Jerry says, $150,000 for a car? Geez. "I guess so. Sure, go ahead." She says, "You're the best, honey," and hangs up. Jerry hangs up the phone and puts it down. His buddies at the gym say, "Jerry, we had no idea you had that kind of cash." Jerry says, "I don't. I'm flat broke. By the way, any of you know whose cell phone this is?" I punch the Facebook icon next to the video button on my iPhone, which transfers the video immediately to the Facebook page I share with Stuart. My sister, Patty, who understands these contraptions better than anyone I know, somehow configured that Facebook button onto my camera so I could automatically upload videos. Otherwise, I'd be clueless as to how to do it. I hadn't visited Stuart in his nursing home for months. I met him at the Children's Memorial Hospital 3 years ago, when we both sat in the ICU for weeks. For Stuart, it was his grandson, who'd been hit by a car and was clinging to life. Making him laugh at my corny jokes was the only thing that got me through it all. Somehow sending him my stand-up routines at the hole in the wall and posting the occasional joke like this made me feel like I was doing a good deed. His granddaughter once told me that he checked that Facebook page every single day, first thing in the morning. I looked up from my phone and immediately looked down again, having caught a glimpse of Ramona De La Vue's shiny blonde hair. So she was in the bar area, seated on the opposite end from me. I turned away and moved between two businessmen, which wasn't hard in this rugby scrum, so I could get another look from a hidden vantage point. I raised my eyes and saw enough to see Ramona turn to her left, talking to someone. She seemed to be keeping her voice down, showing some discretion. But I couldn't see the person next to her, because the bar was wrapped around the liquor station in the middle, the bottles of booze obscuring my view. So I moved to my left to get a better angle, to see the person with whom she was conversing. I was hoping that it would be a man, that Ramona De La Vue, now out of a job as the manager of the Brownstone Brothel, was returning to her previous calling as a prostitute, that I could catch her in the act and make her an offer she couldn't refuse. Tell me where the black book is, or violate your bond and go back in the clink. I positioned myself behind some people and shot another look across the bar at Ramona. I peeked and looked back down at my phone. Then I peeked again. My heart kicked into overdrive. I couldn't believe what I'd just seen. Maybe, I told myself, it was the dim lighting. Maybe I just didn't get a good look. I looked again, holding my stare, even though I might be recognized, even though I knew what I'd seen. Dim lighting or not, I hadn't made a mistake. Ramona Dillavu wasn't talking to a man. She was talking to a woman. A woman I knew very well.
33. Patty, I mumbled to myself. I worked my way through the crowd and out the door into a throng of people. I pulled up my collar as I walked down the wind tunnel that was Rush Street, the question buzzing through my head. What was my sister doing with Ramona Dillavu, the manager of the Brownstone brothel? I couldn't make it fit. It just didn't make sense. I pivoted suddenly and turned back toward the restaurant, almost colliding with a couple right behind me who didn't appreciate my sudden stop. I stepped back and looked toward the restaurant, as though if I stared at it long enough, something would change. I considered returning to the bar and taking yet another look, but of course that made no sense either. I'd seen what I'd seen. What the hell are you doing, Patty? I continued south toward my car, navigating through the crowd of lively pedestrians, the sounds of car horns blaring and drivers yelling and tipsy people laughing and chatting. I pulled out my car keys, a natural thing to do since I was heading toward my car. I bumped into a man coming toward me on my right and let my keys fall behind me. I mumbled an apology and bent down, creating a small space as people navigated around me. Excuse me, I said. Sorry. I grabbed my keys off the wet sidewalk, righted myself, turned back, and headed to my car. It was double parked on Rush. It was a small miracle that it was still there. I had pushed my luck. I was hoping that I had a little bit of luck left, because I was going to need it. Or so I thought. It's a cliche for a cop to talk about his gut, his hunch, but cliches aren't always wrong. It's part experience and part intuition. It didn't hurt that I'd been working undercover with BIA for the last 3 years either. It helped me know how to pick up the signs. It's not hard to do. If you're in that mode, it's almost automatic. You stop and glance over your shoulder when a pretty woman passes, or you stop at a corner, waiting for the traffic light to change and turn back, or you allow yourself to bump into someone and pretend to drop your keys. Any excuse to take a look behind you. You don't look directly at any one person. You don't make eye contact. No, you just take in the crowd. You look for any tickling of a sensation that someone is moving as you move, stopping as you stop, shadowing your movements. I couldn't be sure. I couldn't swear to it. But I had a pretty good idea that somebody was tailing me. And now, I had to decide what to do about it. 34. I got in my car and drove north, the only direction I could go. I made a quick left and then another onto State Street, now heading south, navigating potholes and death-defying pedestrians who zigzagged through traffic to cross the street. In Chicago, obeying don't walk signs is usually considered optional. The distractions forced me to train my focus forward on the road, though my eyes continually shot into the rearview mirror to see what was happening behind me. Traffic was thick, and in the dark it was all headlights behind me. That helped when I was following Ramona Dillavu. She never could have made me for a tail. But apparently, it hindered me too, because I didn't notice at the time that somebody was following me. And the traffic hindered me now too. I couldn't make out the colors, or even the makes of cars in my rearview mirror, much less see their occupants. But that was okay. There was more than one way to sniff out a tail. Traffic behind me dissipated as I moved west and south, away from the Gold Coast. But it was still pretty heavy, giving my tail sufficient cover. I wanted to go home. I wanted to pace around my townhouse, pour myself a stiff drink, and ponder why, in God's name, my sister, Patty, would have been meeting with the manager of a brothel, presumably the guardian of the prized little black book. But I couldn't go home, because I didn't want my tail to stop following me. If he knew me, and he must have, then he knew where I lived. Once he saw me pull up to my building, he'd assume I was going in for the night. He'd keep his distance. He might even call it a night himself. And I didn't want him to call it a night, so I didn't go home. From Chicago Avenue, I turned right onto Damon,
and kept my car at an even speed. Damon probably wasn't the best choice, because as I drove north, the area became crowded again, with restaurants and bars and some pretty high-end boutiques, too. Once you got north of North Avenue. 15 years ago, this was the cool place to live, where the artists and hipsters hung out. That crowd was still here, but it had attracted more yuppies and even some families, people who could afford the sky-high property values. But I didn't care about the gentrification of Wicker Park or Bucktown at the moment. I was more interested in the sedan 3 cars behind me, which thus far had made every turn I had made. See, the route I'd taken was unusual. I'd started on Rush Street, going north, then done a loop to head south on State Street to Chicago Avenue. Then I drove west to Damon, and now I was heading north again on Damon to Armitage, which was 1 mile north from where I originally started, my double park spot on Rush. My route, in other words, made no sense. The guy who said that the shortest distance between 2 points is a straight line, that guy would have said I was an idiot. Why go to all that trouble to head south when I could have just kept going north from Tyson's on Rush Street? I'd gone completely out of my way. Instead of a straight line, my route looked like a humpbacked serpent. You know what I looked like? I looked like either, one, a tourist who didn't know his way around Chicago, or two, someone who was trying to be surreptitious about his movements. And my tail knew I wasn't a tourist. But the other benefit was that I could now say the same thing about the guy following me. The only reason for him to take this route was to tail me. With my right hand on the steering wheel, I used my left to slip my piece out of my side holster, ejecting the magazine to check the clip. I had enough bullets. It usually only takes one. Not that I planned on using it. I'm a lover, not a fighter. I'm a sweetheart of a guy. Confrontation is never my first choice, but sometimes you can't avoid it. And a Boy Scout is always prepared. I turned left off Damon onto Dickens, driving west again. We were in an area that still hadn't decided if it was going to be upscale residential or semi-industrial. I drove another 1 mile or so before I hung a right. Now I had 3 blocks of driving ahead of me, straight north on a quiet street, so I could see behind me pretty clearly. There in the distance, a good city block behind me, the sedan made the same turn. It was no coincidence. We'd left coincidence in the dust miles ago. I pulled into an abandoned lot that once upon a time was home to a bank with a drive-in wing on the side. Some stray garbage was littered about. No reason, no good reason, for anyone to be here this time of night. I pulled up next to the drive-through lane and stopped. I wanted to make sure that my tail had a good look at me. I put the car in park, but kept it running. I fished through the glove compartment until I found an empty envelope. The sedan drove past on the road. It slowed a bit as the driver, I assume, was trying to get a look at what I was doing. If he had any kind of a scope and could see into my car, he would probably think I was waiting for somebody. The sedan drove on. He didn't have much of a choice. He was too conspicuous, on a side street that wasn't busy. With me sitting idly in an abandoned parking lot, he couldn't stay where he was. I scribbled a note on the envelope, took a photo of it with my phone so I wouldn't forget the details, and got out of my car. It was colder than a mother-in-law's glare out here. The wind in open space came at me from all directions. I made a point of looking all around me, as though I were making sure that nobody was watching. Then I walked over to the slot by the teller's window and placed the envelope inside it. I jogged back to my car and got in and drove out of the parking lot, back to the street I'd originally taken, but this time driving in the opposite direction, south. "Your move," I said, looking in my rearview mirror. I drove at normal speed, my eyes glued to the mirror. I was more than 2 blocks down, almost at Dickens, and the car still hadn't come out from wherever it was hiding to follow me. That's what I figured. He wasn't going to follow me. He was going to see what I had dropped in that teller slot. 35. I made a right onto Dickens, which is the direction my tail would expect me to take if I were going home. I lived about 2 miles from this spot, to the south and west. But I wasn't going home. I turned right on the next street and headed north, back to the abandoned bank, approaching it from the other side. I picked this location for a reason. Many moons ago, when I first made detective,
We caught a pickpocket who was working this neighborhood. We had several complaints in the span of a single week, and it didn't take Sherlock Holmes to quickly discover that the victims had one thing in common. The last thing they'd done before their pockets were picked was withdraw money from the ATM at this bank. Not the drive-through window, but the walk-up vestibule, encased in glass and locked in the evenings, but open during the day. The thing was, the thief didn't just steal the victims' wallets. He also went immediately to the closest ATM and emptied their bank accounts of the maximum amount the bank would allow for a single withdrawal. How, I wondered, being the new eager detective that I was, could the thief figure out the ATM password so quickly? Sure, maybe he had some sophisticated computer software, but this was several years ago, before that sort of thing was as rampant as it is today. And besides, he was using the ATM card within minutes, if not seconds, of the theft. So I did a wee bit more detective work, and realized that one end of the bank's parking lot was bordered by trees. I decided to kill a bit of time in an unmarked vehicle down the street. It only took 3 hours until a white male, a teenager fitting the description of the suspect, climbed a tree and trained his binoculars on the ATM vestibule. Well, I didn't need to climb a tree tonight. Binoculars wouldn't have hurt, but I didn't have any. So I crawled over to the shrubs and kept low. The view of the teleslot was nice and clear. It was dark in the vacant lot, but if it was dark for me, it would be dark for him, too. He'd probably need a flashlight, and with any luck, the light coming off it would give me enough illumination to see this asshole's face. The sedan that followed me here pulled up to the intersection where the bank was located. The guy probably wanted to wait a while to make sure nobody was around, to be confident that I'd left for good. Then the car pulled into the parking lot and drove toward the teller window of the drive-up, just where I'd been. The car's headlights shone into my face. That wouldn't help. It would make things harder. But maybe he'd walk past the headlights, which would light him up nicely for me. All I needed to know was who he was, just a quick shot of his face. The car stopped but kept running, the headlights still on. "Come on," I whispered. The car door opened. The interior dome light came on, which would have been my chance to see his face, but those damn headlights blinded me. So I needed him to walk around the front of the car, passing by the headlights. No luck. He went around the rear of the car. With headlights shining in my face and no other illumination in the parking lot, I couldn't see much besides a figure. A figure bundled up in a heavy jacket and hat in the frigid evening air, heading over to the teller window. I could hear just fine. The ka-thunk, as the slot at the teller window opened and closed. Then a pause, while my new friend tried to read the note I'd left. "Flashlight," I mumbled. "Flashlight." He used the glow from his phone to put some light on the note. But he was turned away, so the small amount of illumination from the phone didn't give me anything. I could see the piece of paper in his hand, but whoever this person might be was hunched over, reading it. All I could get was a heavy jacket and some kind of a hat on his head. Then the glow disappeared. Another ka-thunk, as my newest, bestest buddy closed up the slot on the teller window. Then he got back in the car. I tried to get a look inside, but the headlights were still hitting me head-on. And when the car turned and the headlights swept away from me, I couldn't see my hand in front of my face. I had my phone out, ready to hit the flashlight app so I could catch the license plate, but I couldn't risk giving away my position. The sedan left the parking lot and drove away. So I struck out. But that was okay. I'd have another chance soon. Still crouched in the bushes, I clicked on my phone and looked at the photograph I took of the note I left in the teller slot. It said, "Tomorrow, 6 p.m., Red Line, Jackson Stop, northbound platform. Bring it with you." The guy tailing me had read the note. That much I could see. If he was curious about me already, and he must have been, he'd be very interested indeed in finding out whom I was meeting with and what that person was going to bring along. He'd be there. And this time, I would see him coming. "See you tomorrow night, my friend," I said, as the car disappeared from sight. 36. I should have gone home after that. I should have gone back to my townhouse and poured myself a stiff drink or six, so I could think about the two questions I couldn't get out of my mind. What was my sister, Patty, doing talking to the manager of the Brownstone brothel? And who the hell was following me? But I didn't feel like making myself crazy just at that moment, so I went to the hole in the wall. It was full of cops and bunnies, as usual. Most of them were well into their pints, which was fine with me. I didn't need conversation. I just needed the white noise of the crowd, the heat and animation. A couple shots of bourbon wouldn't hurt either. Detective Lanny Socha, Soche, was over in a corner, holding forth with a few of his buddies, probably going on about the Blackhawks' second line, though I doubt anyone could understand half the words he was saying. He raised his pint in salute when he saw me, spilling some of the beer on his shirt. The best part was he didn't even realize it. Now the best part was that he'd be at his desk at 8 sharp tomorrow morning, ready to go. Soche was one of those cops who drank a lot to get through all the shit he saw on the job, but he always came back for more. They'd have to pry his badge out of his dying hand, even if they might have to pry a bottle of Budweiser out of the other. I took a couple of shots of Maker's Mark at the bar and then looked over the crowd. I heard a woman's laugh, and it registered with me. I turned and saw Amy Lentini, sitting at a high table with some guy. A good-looking guy, I noted, also noting that I felt a small knot form in my stomach. Oh, shit, I thought. Fair play to her. She could have her pick of the litter. She probably had guys crawling out of the woodwork to ask her out. I had to admit, I had underestimated her. She was smart as hell, and apparently she brought some credentials to the job. A former federal prosecutor, a high-profile takedown of a U.S. senator in Wisconsin, and she twisted me up like a pretzel when we did a mock cross-examination. Watch that one, I reminded myself. Watch that one closely. She caught my eye and froze for a moment. I nodded to her. She gave me the finger, then smiled. I felt something lift, something that usually got me in trouble. The guy she was with had sandy brown hair and a thick neck and shoulders. Your basic high school homecoming king, varsity letterman guy, who had done just fine in the professional world, flashing that smile, nodding that tie just so, timing that joke perfectly. He probably secretly wore ladies' undergarments and still sucked his thumb when he curled up with his teddy bear at night. That wasn't fair. I didn't even know the guy. He could be totally different from that. For all I knew, he snuck out at night to screw barnyard animals. And what the hell was my problem, by the way? What did I care what Amy Lentini did in her spare time? If she wanted to gallivant around with some eye candy who has the IQ of a tree stump, who's to tell her no? Certainly not I, told myself as I downed my third shot of bourbon and asked for a fourth. I didn't care about Amy Lentini. No, not one bit. Then I saw Lieutenant Mike Goldberger moving my way. I felt a rush of relief. Goldie was my port in the storm. Everybody needs one. I needed one right now, in fact. Goldie liked to have a cocktail now and then, sure, but that's not why he came to the hole. He came here because this was where everybody talked, especially after too many pints of Guinness. He liked to lie low, say very little, gently prod the conversation forward, as if he were just being polite, when in fact he was collecting and filing every piece of data. He knew more things about more cops than anybody I knew. "How's things?" he asked, leaning against the bar, telling the bartender he'd have the same shot of